From the studios of Free Radio Santa Cruz, you're listening to Earth First Radio. Stay tuned for No Compromise news, views, poetry, and music.
You're cutting chainsaws, killing the trees, something everything that lives in peace. Our animal friends are on the run.
Welcome to Earth First Radio. I'm Uncle Dennis. Every week I bring you No Compromise news, views, poetry, and music for activists on the front lines of the environmental movement. In the news, you'll hear about folks who are killing the planet and folks who have detailed information about saving what's left. They all have names, addresses, phone numbers, fax numbers, email, and web addresses. So please go get a pencil or a pen and some recycled paper to write down the information, because this isn't couch potato radio, it's activist radio. I urge you to take down the information and act on it. You really can make a difference by writing letters, sending faxes, and making phone calls when you aren't out in the woods, up in a tripod or a tree sit, or locked down in the Dragon at the road blockade. If you have information, announcements, or comments for Earth First Radio, please keep a pencil handy and listen for the contact addresses later on in the show. Let's start out here with animal announcements. The U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service has extended the time for public to comment on critical habitat for the recovery of the grizzly bear. Population in Yellowstone ecosystem has been extended until October 30, 1999. The overall objective of the grizzly bear recovery is to assure the long-term existence of a grizzly population in all areas where a viable population can be sustained south of the Canadian border. Available bear habitat is often determined by human activities. As grizzly bear recovery efforts continue, habitat criteria will be developed for each grizzly bear and each grizzly bear ecosystem to address the food, vegetation, habitat, and human activities in that specific area included in the habitat plan or specific habitat needs in areas impacted by roads and trails, development, and livestock grazing on public lands. Why don't we just stop grazing on public lands? It'll take care of their one problem. Monitoring of the most important grizzly bear foods, nuisance bear control actions, bear-human conflicts, bear-hunter conflicts, and bear-livestock conflicts are some of the parameters considered in the plan. When completed, the final habitat-based recovery criteria will be appended to the grizzly bear recovery plan. Here's where you come in. You need to write your comments and have them postmarked by October 30th or submitted by electronic mail. And the electronic mail address is fw6_grizzly@fws.gov. That's fw6_grizzly@fws.gov. And please include habitat criteria in the subject line of the message. You folks who understand email will understand what that's all about. All right, let's move on to some more announcements here. Coming up in October, the National Forest Protection Convention, brought to you by the National Forest Protection Alliance, will hold its national convention to discuss and build upon the campaign to protect public lands from commercial exploitation, especially logging, near Carbondale, Illinois. I guess that's where they're going to have it. Find out more about this, contact Jeanette Russell. Her email address, Russell, R-U-S-S-E-L-L, at wildrockies.org. And there's the bike ride for Southeastern Forests going on through the month of October. Five members of Earth Culture of Greensboro, North Carolina, will ride 1,000 miles to defend Southeastern Forests. They'll have 23 demonstrations against wood products facilities. Contact Rick Spencer for dates and locations. His number, 336-691-0022. That's 336-691-0022. Coming up is the Centennial Conference for the Southern Appalachians, October 22nd and 23rd. Southern Appalachian Forest Coalition will host a day-long conference in Asheville at the North Carolina Arboretum, followed by a celebratory evening at the Grove Park Inn in honor of the 1899 establishment of the Southern Appalachian National Forests and Parks. Contact Southern Appalachian Forest Coalition. Their number, 828-252-9223. That's 828-252-9223. And the Northern Rocky Mountains Law Conference, October 30th and 31st. The American Wildlands will host a conference entitled Intersections, Water Quality, Water Quantity, and Native Species. And all this is going to take place probably somewhere in Montana. For more information, contact Judy at 406-586-8175. That's 406-586-8175. And let's see. Moving on, I got a whole new announcement sheet here. Ongoing from September 1st to December 1st is the Columbia and Snake Rivers Campaign Launch Fin Tour. And it's a 25-foot fiberglass salmon that's going to be running around the Midwest, Northeast, and Washington, D.C. If you'd like information about the dates and locations of the tour, go to the following website, www.amrivers.com. .org/snake.html. That's www.amrivers, all one word, .org/snake.html. Let's see. The town hall meetings on roadless area protections will be September 29th, October 13th, and October 20th. American Lands and a number of local and regional partners will hold a series of town meetings to promote the protection of 60 million acres of roadless areas in our national forest. The three events with dates and contact information are Traverse City, Michigan on September 29th. Contact Frank at fambrose@bloomington.in.us. That's fambrose, all one word, at bloomington.in.us. Concord, New Hampshire, October 13th. Contact John Demos at jddemos@hotmail.com. And, of course, Nashville, Tennessee, October 20th. Contact Kelly at gcprov@hotmail.com. That's gcprov@hotmail.com. And the Heartwood Reunion, October 1st through 3rd. The Heartwood Reunion offers a time to reflect on the past year and an opportunity to renew our spirits. The reunion will be at the Lazy Black Bear in the middle of the Hoosier National Forest near Paoli, Indiana. If you want more information, contact the Heartwood office at 812-337-8898. That's 812-337-8898. And Keep the Wild Alive online workshop for educators on endangered species. That's October 4th. The National Wildlife Federation will hold its weekly online workshops from October 4th through November 12th for educators. Teachers will actively engage in 6 weeks of online activities, discussions, da-da-da-da-da. If you'd want more information, you need to register. And the deadline is October 1st. Contact the National Wildlife Fund at wildlife, W-I-L-D-L-I-F-E, at nwf.org. That's wildlife at the National Wildlife Foundation.org. Let's see here. The North Columbia Bioregional Conference in Nelson, British Columbia, October 8th through 10th. Kootenay Boundary and Okanagan Greens will coordinate a conference to bring together a collective expertise of activists on the range. Contact Dave at Okanagan Greens. His number, 250-499-5417. That's 250-499-5417. Or Andy at 250-353-7350. That's Andy of the Kootenays at 250-353-7350. And Michigan's first annual Forest Activist Gathering. If you're in Michigan, don't miss this one. October 8th through 10th, the Northwoods Wilderness Recovery Heartwood Forest Forever will host the gathering in Traverse City, Michigan. Come and camp and meet other activists. Contact Marie for more information at 231-326-5505. That's 231-326-5505. Or mail to forestforever62@yahoo.com. That's forestforever62@yahoo.com. All right, and the e-conference 2000, October 15th through 17th. E-conference is a national student environmental conference at the University of Pennsylvania, and lots of groups here, including SEAC, Students Environmental Action Coalition. Want more information? Go to their website, www.econference2000.org. That's econference2000.org, or call 877-ECO-STUDENT. That's 877-ECO-STUDENT for more information. All right. And there's more stuff off in November, but I'll tell you all about that later on. Here is our lead story for tonight, and concerns activists in British Columbia. Dateline September 17th, Vancouver, British Columbia, Canada. 8 forest conservationists were violently assaulted in the old-growth forest of the Alajo Valley last Wednesday, about 200 kilometers north of Vancouver. The victims allege they were beaten by loggers from Interfor and Alajo Valley Logging Company. James Jameson of our Millennium Tree Survey camp coordinator reported to us that at about 11 p.m. on Wednesday of last week, many pickup trucks with Interfor International Forest Products and Alajo Valley Logging Company written on their doors began to surround him and seven other conservationists in an upper Alajo Valley camp, said Joe Foy, WCWC campaign coordinator. The camp does not belong to the WCWC, but is organized by the Forest Action Network and People's Actions for Threatened Habitat. These grassroots action groups are dedicated to keeping the temperate rainforests of British Columbia intact. Operating out of a separate camp nearby, Jameson had been surveying and mapping trees over 1,000 years old for WCWC's campaign to preserve the Stoltman Wilderness as a national park. About 2 hours later, Foy received a desperate satellite phone call from Jameson, who said that he was locked in his van and surrounded by some 100 angry loggers. The phone call abruptly ended. At once, Foy called the Squamish Royal Canadian Mounted Police and was told by Sergeant Gary Bryan that officers had already been dispatched to the area. Before police arrived, Jameson was dragged from his van, punched and kicked and thrown to the ground. One man raised a boulder over his head and threatened to smash Jameson's brains in. Jameson's van was damaged. WCWC's two-way radio and Jameson's cameras were stolen. Other conservationists in the camp fared even worse. Cameras were forcibly removed from conservationists and smashed. One woman's neck was injured as she was jerked around by loggers, ripping her video camera off. A male conservationist was beaten and punched. His eye and knee were injured. Other women conservationists and a 15-year-old boy were beaten severely. Jameson reported that an Interfor employee videotaped the attacks and laughed as the conservationists were being beaten. At 2:30 p.m., Jameson, after being prevented from locating four WCWC tree survey volunteers under his charge and camped in the nearby forest, tried to drive his damaged van containing the injured conservationists. Behind him, loggers were burning the path fan camp to the ground. Jameson was immediately followed by a swarm of Interfor trucks. The RCMP had still not arrived. All along the 60-kilometer logging road, Interfor trucks attempted to force him off the road. An Interfor truck passed him at high speed and blocked the road, forcing Jameson to stop. Two men got out of the truck and threw rocks at Jameson's van. Jameson backswerved and escaped. In Squamish, Jameson and other conservationists gave statements to the Squamish RCMP. They were treated at the Squamish hospital and released. Foy and Chris Player, both WCWC employees, traveled up to the camp early Thursday morning to locate the four missing WCWC volunteers. We phoned RCMP Sergeant Bryan and requested an RCMP escort, but he told us that he did not have enough staff, said Foy. We are going up regardless. We intend to maintain our Millennium Tree Survey camp and continue mapping the ancient giants of the Stoltman Wilderness until we are successful in our endeavors to see the area granted national park protection, said Foy. Paul George, WCWC founder, has vowed to seek justice in the courts. We ask the RCMP to uphold the law and hold Interfor accountable, he said. The RCMP Thursday executed a search warrant on Interfor's Squamish office. Police were looking for a videotape of the clash between protesters and loggers, but no videotape was located. While at Interfor's office, Sergeant Bryan was informed by Interfor's operation manager, Dave Miller, that the tape had been destroyed. Police have yet to determine who destroyed the videotape. One arrest was made in the incident, a logging protester who was sitting in a tree at the Fanpath camp. Injured by a rock thrown by loggers, his belongings were burned before he was taken into custody. The police investigation continues. And a hearing in British Columbia Supreme Court today may have shed some light on the fate of the videotape that recorded the incident. The case brought by Interfor was to seek an expanded injunction that would keep conservationists and protesters away from the logging area. And just as Mr. Justice Glenn Parrett was about to make his ruling, the Interfor lawyer jumped up and said that the company, too, had looked for the tape. In the course of that search, the attorney said he had spoke to an Interfor employee who shot the tape. He was told that persons unknown had asked the employee for the tape, using a threat of force for him to hand it over. The unknown person threw the tape off the Lava Creek Bridge. The judge responded that the dog ate my homework excuse would not be successful in court. Judge Perrette ruled that not only would the 500-meter bubble zone around the logging work area stay in place, but he added a 200-meter exclusion zone around the logging road entry points. Still, Western Canadian Wilderness Committee researchers won more freedom for their activities than they had previously enjoyed. And Adrian Carr, director for WTWC, said, "Before, every time we wanted to go through, we had to inform Interfor about the timing and how long we would be there. Now we don't have to do that. Now anyone authorized by us will be conducting what the judge called legitimate and worthwhile research and activities, must carry a WCWC card and seal on their person, and a list of those people must be maintained in our office. We do not have to seek approval of Interfor for access at any time." And Joe Foy and Chris Player found the four missing volunteer researchers on Thursday. Player volunteered to stay on as camp coordinator. The four volunteers were informed fully, said Carr, and all elected to stay. Foy is returning with more volunteers who want to go up there and work. "We will not back down to bullying," Carr maintained. "We have a legitimate right to be there. This is the most violent attack I've ever heard about in the 15 years that I've been working in British Columbia conservation issues," said Foy. "We simply cannot let these thugs deter us in our efforts to see the Stoltman Wilderness and its thousand-year-old trees preserved for future generations. We call on all British Columbians and on conservationists from around the world to condemn this violent attack and join with us in our quest to preserve the Stoltman Wilderness, Canada's foremost national park candidate." Well, it's pretty ugly news from British Columbia, but it's not unusual, folks. It goes on all the time. Moving on to animal news, this is from Hobart, Tasmania, Australia. Tasmanians are being asked to plant blue gum trees and make their homes and backyards safe for the endangered swift parrot during the upcoming breeding season. Speaking in Hobart today, Dr. Sharman Stone, the Parliamentarian Secretary for the Minister of the Environment and Heritage, said public support could mean the difference between the swift parrot surviving and becoming extinct. Fewer than 1,000 breeding pairs are still alive. The swift parrot, Lathamus discolor, is migratory, spending the winter months in the woodlands and forests from southeast Queensland to Victoria on mainland Australia. These parrots breed during the spring and summer months in Australia's island state of Tasmania. Australia is in the southern hemisphere, where it has just turned spring, and happy equinox to Australians as well as folks all around the world. The birds feed on the nectar of the Tasmanian blue gum and the swamp gum, which flower during the breeding season. Blue gums take 12 years to mature and begin flowering, but the swift parrots only regularly feed from trees over 30 years old. Loss of blue gum habitat, the swift parrot's main source of food and shelter, through land clearing is also a major concern. Blue gums remain under threat from unregulated clearing on private land for agriculture, cropping, and wood chipping, Dr. Stone said. About 80% of the swift parrots preferred the blue gum habitat is located on private land. Blue gum flowers produce a lot of nectar, and this becomes the swift parrot's main food. They will fly up to 10 kilometers from their nest sites in search of it. And moving on to more animal news, there's a battle in the desert over the quote, spotted owl of the desert. An environmental battle is looming across the largest region of western North America, so far relatively untouched by the Endangered Species Act, its vast sage and grassland deserts. At the center of the dispute will be the West's largest native upland bird, the sage grouse, which some environmentalists are beginning to call the spotted owl of the desert. And biologists from the Peregrine Fund will release 8 California condors on top of the hurricane cliffs near the Grand Canyon in northern Arizona on November 18th. This will be the fourth release of North America's largest bird since December of 1996. Once thought to be extinct, the release of these 8 condors will increase the population of California condors in Arizona to 22. And this release is another step towards the recovery of California condors, and we are pleased to initiate a second release site on Hurricane Cliffs, said Bill Burnham, president of the Peregrine Fund. This is the habitat and community support provided in the Grand Canyon area. said Burnham. After a 70-year absence, we are pleased to have gone from a population of zero to 22 California condors in Arizona in just 2 years, said Roger Taylor, director of the Arizona Strip District for the Bureau of Land Management. Public opportunities of the existing wild condors are available near the Vermilion Cliffs in Arizona. Six of the California condors hatched at the World Center for Birds of Prey and two hatched at the L.A. Zoo in 1998 will be released at Hurricane Cliffs. One hatched at the San Diego Wild Animal Park in 1996 and will be released at the Vermilion Cliffs site in late November. All nine condors arrived at the Hurricane Cliffs site on a Bureau of Land Management plane on October 7th and 8th. The condors have been acclimatizing to each other and to their new surroundings in the release facility on top of the cliff. At the time of the release, the birds will know how to fly but are expected to stay close to the release site and explore their new home slowly. The historic Arizona release is a joint project between the Peregrine Fund, U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, Bureau of Land Management, Arizona Game and Fish, and the Coalitions of Resources and Economies, among others. And a scientific assessment of lynx conservation in North America was released chapter by chapter over the Internet starting in August by the U.S. Forest Service. Now issued in its entirety, the report, co-authored by 18 American and Canadian lynx ecologists, addresses all aspects of lynx biology, conservation, and management. The U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service has delayed listing the lynx protection under the Endangered Species Act, justifying delay by the pending release of the report of the scientific basis of lynx conservation. It states, "We know remarkably little about the current status and numbers of lynx in the contiguous United States. However, what little we do know indicates that subpopulations are not large. It is unwise to assume these populations can be reduced or further isolated without sharply increasing the risk of their individual and collective extinction. Fragmentation of habitat, higher road densities, residential development, and the wider use of snowmobiles and devices that compact snow are all threats to lynx survival," the report says. "Large contiguous areas of suitable habitat are necessary for population persistence," according to the lynx biologists. U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service will make a decision whether to list the lynx on January 8th in the year 2000. Public comment is welcome until September, and you can probably make comments as much as you want. Contact Field Supervisor, U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, Montana Field Office, 100 North Park Avenue, Suite 320, Helena, Montana, 59601. That's Field Supervisor, U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, Montana Field Office, 100 North Park Avenue, Suite 320, Helena, Montana, 59601. Email to lynx@fws.gov. That's lynx@fws.gov. And if you want to view the report online, it's located at www.fs.fed.us/r1/lynx.html. That's www.fs.fed.us/r1/lynx.html. And seven rare Oregon silver spot butterflies were captured at Cascade Head Preserve this month and taken from their coastal headland home for a captive rearing project. The butterflies captured by the Nature Conservancy have already started laying eggs at their new home at Lewis and Clark College in Portland, Oregon. After hatching, the young will be maintained in a controlled environment to keep them dormant. Next spring, the caterpillars will be reared and released back to Cascade Head, one of only six locations where this subspecies still exists, said Diane Huang, endangered species biologist for Oregon State Office of the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. "This population has remained low since declines were first noted there in 1993, Huang said. "Our maintaining our known populations is important for the recovery of this subspecies. The captive feeding project is expected to continue for 3 years, and expertise gained from the project may be used to help other declining butterfly species. The project is just one of the newest components of a recovery strategy that focuses on securing and managing known population sites." The butterfly was listed as threatened in 1980 due to loss of its native coastal grassland habitat. Captive propagation is an important conservation tool, especially when used with measures that include habitat conservation and habitat management, U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service Regional Director Ann Badgley. And the Animal Liberation Front has liberated all 46 dogs from a lab animal supplier and research lab, BioDevices, Inc., and spray-painted slogans including "Animal Liberation" and "Vivisection is Fraud" on the walls. The ALF statement said that some of the dogs were injured from surgeries, but that all have now been checked out by a qualified veterinarian and have been placed in good homes. And after deliberating for a day and a half, the U.S. District Court jury found three animal rights activists not guilty in the bombing of a fur farm and the resulting fire, which caused almost $1 million in damage. Prosecutors had relied on the testimony of two men convicted earlier who had faced possible long prison sentences. Let's listen to a little bit of music, and then we'll take a break. Stay tuned.